if there's any way not to lose your children's respect, take it. If you still got their children's respect, I don't care if you're faking it. Thank God you still got it. Keep it. Because getting it back is so much more difficult than losing it.
Welcome to the Skilled Dad Podcast. This is the podcast for dads of all seasons to learn the things that they can do and engage so that they can go and equip the next generation for success. Here we sit down with everyday dads just like you to learn from their story, get inspired, and then start getting after it. So we invite you to join in, see what you can take away from this story, and apply to your life on your journey to becoming a skilled dad. Hey guys, and welcome to the Skilled Dad Podcast. My name is Zach Reeser. I'm your host. And if this is your first time joining us on one of our interviews, I want to say welcome. We're glad that you're here. And if you've been listening for a while, I want to say welcome back as always. I'm glad that you're getting enough that you're like, hey, I need some more. I'm going to go back for some more. And I appreciate all of you that have been reaching out, asking when the new episodes are coming out. And I've had several recorded. They're coming out, and we're also testing the daily podcast. So jump in there. It's 5 minutes or less that we're aiming for. And at the end of the day, we're looking to give you a takeaway and insight, sometimes from great conversations like we're about to have here, as well as learnings that we've had or things that people send in to me. It's just a way for us to collectively work together in our community to help put it out for everyone and in a low consumption way, because I know we're busy, but it's also a place for you to go to if you're kind of needing that pick me up or just that common source to go back to. So go check it out. And if you're new, we'd love that you subscribe, and that way you'll hear all those daily podcasts. But for this episode, I'm excited. My guest tonight, he and I actually talked like a month and a half ago. And so we booked it out, and then we had a couple of changes within the schedule. That's just the way that it works. But man, I'm glad we're here, and we are almost coast to coast tonight, and I've got my guest Wayne Boatwright with me, and I want to say, Wayne, thanks for joining me on the Skilled Dad Podcast.
Thanks, Zach. It's good to be here.
Good to be here, and good to see you. And I know you got your threads on for a big game happening out there, and you're on the West Coast in San Francisco, right?
That's right. And you know, there are little things that you do to stay connected to your kids. My son is a sophomore in college. He goes to school back in New York, and we've bonded over Giants baseball since he was literally 2 or 3 years old. And so I'm wearing a colorful shirt because this is one of those things we got at a giveaway. And the Giants have just started. They've had one series against the Padres, and they're playing their arch rivals, the Dodgers, tonight. So I figured I'd do anything I could to help the team out. So I'm wearing a team shirt. But of course, skilled dad, as we all aspire to be, this is an example of something that I think every dad should take advantage of, and that is to meet your children where they are. So if my kid loves baseball, I'm going to love baseball. Yeah. Look, I grew up in L.A. Uh-huh. I had Dodger blue blood flowing through my veins, right?
Oh, we're switching sides now.
Not at all. I've always been on the side of my son, and I'm still there.
Ooh, you know? Yeah, I like that. Yep. But,
you know, we live in San Francisco. He's been born and raised here. We became Giants fans, and I met him where he was as a Giants fan and became just as passionate about the Giants as I can be, not nearly to his level, but I get close. Believe me, I work hard at it.
Well, you know what you're going to have to do if they win tonight. You're going to wear that shirt for every game until every they game. Lose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, that's baseball and superstition. They go hand in hand.
Yeah, well, and to kind of just trunk, you know, to end this point, he's home on spring break. He just got back. And on Friday is the home opener for the Giants. And we're going to the game together.
Nice.
And
very nice.
Again, my son's 20. He's a sophomore in college. He's got lots of friends and lots of people he could be hanging out with. He wants to go to the home opener of the Giants with his dad. And as an aspirational goal, most of the dads we'll be speaking with, I'm sure their kids are younger than that, you can have that too.
Yeah.
You can have that intimate bond with your children. I don't care what their age is.
Yeah. No, I love that. And I want to say thank you for bringing that point on. You've got quite a story. I want to come back to kind of your touch points. And I know that's a big portion here in a minute. But you've got quite the story that you shared with me. And I know that you use your story to help others. And for those listening, like, it's an impactful story. It is, it can be a difficult story. But to hear what you've done and what you're doing using your story is powerful. But you have an Ivy League education. Mm. You have a law background. Mm. Right? You've done a lot of things with a lot of multinational corporations. Like you've done a lot of things. You've seen some things. You've brokered some big deals. You've been part of big things. And then you had a big change in your life. And I know we'll touch on that. But for now, I'd love to just kind of turn it over to you and give you the mic and say, you know, give us an intro of yourself. And we'll just kind of take it from there if that works for you.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. Let's do it.
Well, let's see. Ideas and stories are kind of, they're like a tapestry. You have a lot of different threads that you weave together to create something colorful. So there's no doubt I've had a colorful life. And to be honest, for many of the people in my peer group, Ivy League educated, you know, Harvard Business School, Yale, Wharton, places like that, they now consider me a black sheep. And I hope I'm a black swan. That's my aspirational goal after what I've gone through. But to get to a fall, you had to have gotten to a height. And I fell a little over a decade ago. But before I explain that, I want to give you an idea of where I came from, because I think that's relevant to this story. I've got a philosophy that life doesn't happen to you. Life happens for you. That orientation is essential. What is it that you need to learn? And when I've come to the challenges of life, many of them of my own making, I've tried to learn from it. And I would encourage everybody to try to have that mindset. Life isn't happening to you. Life is happening for you. And that doesn't make it easy, and you might be frightened of it, but there's something you're supposed to learn. Try to figure out what that is. So to that point, learning has always been important. I'm the classic American success story, the meritocracy incarnate, you would call me. I was raised by a single mother who hadn't graduated high school with a half brother, living in government rent control housing where I shared a bedroom with my brother my whole life. Started working at 15 and a half when it was legal, not 16 as most people think. Mm-hmm. Bought my family's first car, my family's first TV. Tried to make my family's life better as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to put a place marker here.
Yeah.
There are things we do as children that we think are us, and they're merely a defense mechanism we create. So young that we've forgotten we created it. We think it's who we are. So I was very much better, faster, stronger was my mantra growing up. I had to be better, faster, stronger because I could be better, faster, stronger, smarter, dedicated, work hard. And that suited me really well. So well that I was able to, you know, I didn't go to college till I was 21, but when I started, because I was working before that. And I started at a junior college taking remedial courses, but then I went to a Cal State college and went on up the chain and ultimately went to Cornell Law School and became a lawyer. Not the lawyer you see on TV. I was a corporate lawyer. My job was to help people do business around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm not criminal law, not litigation, none of that stuff. And I was in LA for a couple of years, and I went to South Korea for 6 years and worked there. You mentioned, wow, you know, knowing people. Yeah, I met George Soros. I met Michael Bloomberg. I met the King of Norway. Wow. I even partied with Stevie Wonder and his band one night. My the best man in my wedding, who was a naval intelligence guy who's retired to First Georgia and now Alabama, he literally called me 2 days ago and was making fun of me because he goes, "Hey, I was there too. Why didn't you mention me?" And I'm like, it was just an example.
Plausible deniability. You know, in case he's listening to this, right?
Right.
Maybe Intel, plausible
deniability. I'm trying to help him. I'm trying to help him here. I was able to do a lot of great stuff and came back to the U.S. to work with Accenture, which is a global consulting firm, and had a global position with them. So traveled all over the world with Accenture and literally, you know, Paris, London, Madrid, Tokyo, Sydney, didn't matter. I went all over the place. Athens, you know. And then I got bit by the startup bug. And I think the mindset that I brought to the rest of my life really solidified during that time, because it gave me, I was based in San Francisco back then, and the creativity and the willingness to take risks and try new things, I was really attracted to that. The ability to try new things, even if it fails, doesn't matter. There's so much potential. What could we do? How can we do these things differently? What could we do better?
Right.
And on the career front, that also means you have lots of challenges. And one of the coping mechanisms that I used for my challenges was alcohol. And my better, faster, stronger, proudful mindset told myself, wow, this coping mechanism is working pretty well. So I started drinking more. And, you know, it's a mental and a physical thing. Your body does become physically addicted to substances. It's not just your mind craving them. Right. But the core of the thing is recognizing it's a coping mechanism. I think people misname it when they call it a disease, because that allows people an out. No, you're using it for a reason. There's something that you're hiding from, something you can't face, something you can't deal with. And you're using a coping mechanism. And it could be cigarettes, it could be alcohol, it could be drugs, it could be sex, it could be porn. It doesn't matter.
Right.
These are all coping mechanisms. And if you don't recognize it as a coping mechanism, you're never going to be able to. I doubt many people can solve it until they recognize it's just a coping mechanism. And if they can put away that coping mechanism, focus on the problem that underlies that and deal with that issue, most likely they won't need that coping mechanism ever again. So my case was alcohol. In fact, I was dealing with a lot of challenges, some career, but mainly family ones. And I thought drinking alcohol was a way of coping with it. And so I was proudful. And that pride wasn't me. That pride was a defense mechanism I built up as a young kid who had to be better, faster, stronger to succeed in the life that I had. So it suited me well as a kid. But it doesn't suit an adult.
Yeah.
It wasn't what I needed where I was facing challenges. You know, we always have to be willing to learn and to grow.
Yeah.
And I couldn't face the hit to my pride that was going on. So to cope for that, I used another coping mechanism, which was alcohol. And in fact, my fall, as I like to call it, was I was drinking so much one night and continued to drink while I was driving on the road from LA to San Francisco, that I got blackout drunk and was so drunk I was going the wrong way on the freeway, and I had a head-on collision and I took a life and injured three other people. So I'm that guy. I'm the drunk driver that is the black hat for many people in the world. And even if it was my first time, I'm sure it could have happened before that. I know it could have happened before that time.
Sure.
So that was my fall, as I like to call it. I took a life. You think you know who you are. You take a life and you're going to reassess a lot of things.
Right.
Starting from very foundational elements, at least I did. So that was the fall. And that led to me spending 6 years in San Quentin State Prison. My crime occurred when my kids were 5 and 7, dad. And they were 6 and 8 when I went to prison. So I left them when they were very young and their developmental level was very young. Before I let you jump in, I got to tell you, we don't remember those developmental levels, but as a dad, you need to. because my daughter, I abandoned her. My son, I abandoned him in their minds. Now, I tried to explain to them that I was serving sentence, that I had broken society's laws, that I'd done something bad, and that society required that I pay for that, and I was more than willing to pay for it. I had a duty as a citizen. They don't understand those concepts.
Right.
Dad abandoned us and left us. And so they feel a lot of pain, and they feel shame that you've committed a crime. Don't get me wrong. But that's their developmental level. And right. we need to remember that as dads. You have to meet the kids where they are, not just in the stuff they're doing, but developmentally how they understand things.
Yeah. You're exactly right. They know dad's not there. And that's, you said 6 and 8. Is that right? Yeah. Dad was there. Dad's not there. Now, to go back just a little bit, so you had been in Korea for 6 years and all these places you're traveling. Were you traveling frequently? So,
and I had a 3-year stint in Vegas on a 700 plus unit condominium development that I brokered the deal and the financing and then became general counsel for. So I was going to Vegas, you know, Monday through Thursday. Trust me, no weekends in Vegas, but I was doing it 3-4 times a month. So I was traveling a lot.
Yeah. And this is, so for those of you that are listening that are in the frequent traveler business travel world, I was in it for 8 years. Like especially the hypermobile. And what I mean by hypermobile is like, it's a weekly thing. It's not even a 50% travel. 50% travel, I can imagine you'd see some same things, but in a sales world or in a deal world or things like that, it's not uncommon, you know, when you're going to dinner, you're having some drinks. When you're entertaining people, you're having some drinks. When you're doing deals, you're having some drinks. When you're traveling, like it's somewhat can be some of the culture as well. So you're around it. And then, you know, for you, you know, you had mentioned it was, you know, it is a coping thing when it gets to a place where it's, I say beyond our control for lack of a better term, but when it gets to a place where we need to settle down, then it's become something more. What was it you think? I mean, you, by all extensive perspectives outside of your world, if someone would look at you, I don't know if you ever got this, but someone would look at you and when I would travel, they'd say, oh, you live the glamorous business travel lifestyle, right? You had it made in many ways from outsiders' perspectives, I'd imagine. So two questions. One is, what do you think that was kind of that coping thing? Unless that's a sensitive area, then we just don't go into it. The second is what was your parenting style like when your kids were 6 and 8 and a day before what happened with you? And having a few too many drinks and then, you know, like that, everything changes. Like what was your parenting style like prior to the accident and prior to being sentenced to go to San Quentin?
Wow. That's a great pair of questions. You want to find out who you really are. And coping mechanisms allow you to avoid that. So I would contend if you're traveling a lot, you're going to find out who you really are because nobody knows you. You can be whoever you want to be in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And can you face that? Can you face who you actually are? Not who you tell yourself you are, not what everybody thinks you are. And those are hard things to face. And I think any addiction, and I mean that generally like that, at its core begins as a sense of a sense of selfishness, to be honest. You're trying to take a shortcut to get to somewhere you want to be, whether you want to be happy or fulfilled or with a girl, whatever it is that you think you want. You're taking a shortcut to get there. And there's an arrogance in that. you know, that the rules don't apply to you. You know, you can drink and drive. Rules don't apply to me. I'm fine. I drink and drive how much times I can do it. No problem.
I'm fine. Yep.
There's an arrogance in that. And, you know, my particular situation is mine, and I'll think about whether it's something I want to talk about, not because I'm uncomfortable, but because I don't want people to use me as an excuse to not face their problem.
Sure.
You know, the wonderful thing about our existence is we're all unique. We're all individuals. We all have our own life that we've lived and the experiences we've had. And I don't begrudge anybody the scars that they've gained and the challenges that they've overcome or failed at. That's their life. Yeah. I want to respect that. But I want our audience to know that regardless of what my challenges were, they should be looking at what are the coping mechanisms that they're using to avoid feeling uncomfortable, to avoid feeling inadequate, to avoid acknowledging that there's something else that they have to do. And I think that's even more difficult in our modern era because nobody's allowed to contemplate anything anymore. Technology demands that we entertain ourselves 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many hours do our children spend on electronic devices now?
Mm-hmm.
They're not allowed to be bored. They've got to entertain themselves all the time. And so the ability to take the time to think about these things is not easy in our modern society. But I want to, you know, I suggest people try to make time for that.
Yeah.
And whether that's meditation or prayer or a walk by yourself, do something to kind of think about these things. Because entertainment isn't the answer to everything. That's distracting you. That's another coping mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my case, pride was great. Got me to Cornell Law School. Right. But probably made me more of an arrogant asshole, excuse the language, than I had to. And it also meant that I couldn't ask for help when I had challenges. I couldn't even ask my wife for help. Right. I'd want to hide my drinking. And I was by the time I committed my crime, I was drinking at home alone during the day. Right. If anybody thinks that, if they're not sure if they have a drinking problem, one simple test, do you drink alone sometimes? If you're drinking alone, you've got a problem as far as I'm concerned. Alcohol is a social experience, or it's meant to lubricate it. If you're using it for a different purpose, you're using it as a coping mechanism. And so you just ask yourself, why do you need that coping mechanism? What is it that you're uncomfortable facing? But the other challenge is trying to face it alone. And unfortunately for me, that was the 1-2 punch. I was so proudful that I couldn't admit I had a problem. And yet I couldn't face what I needed to face. So I used another coping mechanism along with pride, and that was drinking to kind of numb my emotions. The other thing we do a lot as kids, and we don't, especially those who've lived in a tough environment, one concept is known as the ACE score, which is the adverse childhood experience score. Mm. I doubt that the fathers who are listening to this podcast, that their children have a very high ACE score. It's probably really low. I was in San Quentin State Prison. Those guys were up there and there's 15 different things they measure. They were all up there above 7, 8, 9, 10 adverse childhood experiences, like parents divorced, living with a single parent, not having a steady job, not having a steady home, dropping out of school or having challenges. These can all up your ACE score that you have, right? And I think that for me, that need for pride was perfectly justified as a child. But not something I really needed as an adult, but I'd had it for so long, I thought it was me, not just a defense mechanism I was using.
And that your identity.
Differentiate that is a real challenge for me, and I think for many people.
Yeah. Sounds like with your experience growing up, I mean, you said early on that you were working to help provide for the family, right? You were stepping in, and there are times for some of us, at different ages where we have the opportunity and somewhat required to step up and grow up a little faster than maybe we would want to. But it sounds like that pride, as you say, and drive became some of that identity. And then once you started seeing more wins and successes, it kind of started to build to the point where, you know, you had the fall.
I couldn't ask for help. Mm-hmm. I think that is the main, beyond the coping mechanism of alcohol, the other main factor was I just wasn't able to ask for help. And that was that pride. And that pride also has you hide your alcohol. So I was a functional alcoholic, you could say. But there were times that I had, in my mind, bad days, but they weren't bad days. I was an alcoholic. I had good days is the way to think of it. Not that I had bad days, right? I had days where I could hide it successfully.
Right.
Because that means you have, that's one way you can face these challenges is to admit something like that.
Yeah.
To admit you have a problem and find somebody to talk with. And it may not be your spouse. It may be the group that you've created with skilled dads. You know, I don't know, but people need to find an ability to ask for help.
Yeah. And one, this theme comes up a lot. So for those of you that have listened to multiple episodes, you're going to keep hearing it. You're going to hear it right now and you're going to keep hearing it. And that is to have a couple guys around you that know you well enough to be able to kick you in the pants when you step out of line. And it's hard. It's for many people that don't have that, it is hard to go and get it because it takes work and it takes investment. And, you know, in modern day, shooting to text somebody, see if they want to hang out, shooting to text somebody just to see what they're doing. And it's give and take. It's not just shooting text when you need something, because then you become known as the guy that only texts when you need something or want something. But having those two or three, and if you're fortunate enough to have more than that, guys around you that you can be real with, and they know where the bodies are buried, so to speak, with you and vice versa. Those guys will also usually not hesitate to kind of grab you by the shirt collar and say, hey, what's going on, man? You know, hey, everything all right? And just kicking the pants. And that's a good thing, because sometimes when we have that blind spot that's created where our pride gets a little high, or we're coming off arrogant, or we're talking to our wife in a certain way in social situations or whatever it might be, you know, they keep us in check. And that's my rant for this moment, but I'm passionate about it because I saw some things in that world and, you know, experienced things in the business travel world specifically.
Where you do get, oh, yeah.
You oh, see yeah. things, you know, and I lost, lost proverbially or metaphorically people to some bad decisions, right? Some of it was alcohol, some of it was adultery, some of it, you know, different things. And it's just, it can be tough. And so having those people around you so that you're not isolated, and that's where the isolation, I think, is a big issue. If you're listening to this podcast, don't consider yourself isolated. Consider it a starting point, and we want to do everything we can to help you get that group. So anyway, I divert, but no, I appreciate you saying that. And it's like, it's hard to ask for help, especially if you weren't used to it. And maybe not having the community infrastructure around you to have the people to ask that help to or from. I'm going to speculate a little bit, but in your environment, in a very high level, multinational business environment, there's also some elements of, you know, coworkers, you can have real close relationships, but sometimes there's still some competitiveness that you have to guard yourself some. And in some cases, there's politics involved and like internal business politics. So that can be an isolating factor as well. So I'm just throwing out some of those pieces there that I've seen, been a part of, and that I'm kind of imagining is some of the world that maybe you were in. Am I off base or?
No, but again, we each travel our own path, right? Yeah. So we each have to find our own way to address those issues. Mm-hmm. It's also a space of amazing collaboration, right? Because yes. we come from an opportunity to work with really talented people. And yes, competition's part of it. And you want to be able to hold up your end. But I will never know if that community had similar challenges and maybe had tools that I could have used. Because I didn't have the courage to ask anybody. I didn't even have the courage to ask my wife, forget about the business stuff.
Right.
For help. Right. And I think that isolating experience that an addiction can bring us, especially if we're, as is common, hiding it from everybody, is the danger that people face. But the danger is they focus all their time on how to stop, in my case, let's say stop drinking. But Matthew Perry, who was a famous actor, passed away a couple of years ago, drug overdose, right?
Yeah.
I bet he spent millions of dollars to deal with his addiction. I bet money that he did, because we've all heard about it for like 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I call that building a wall around the thing that triggers you, you know, that triggers the need for the coping mechanism. And I'm sure he built a great wall around that. But you know what? We're really talented people, and we can always find a way around that wall. So the addiction isn't the problem. The addiction's a coping mechanism for the problem.
Right.
You have to find out what the problem is. And that can be in a small group format. That can be with a mental health professional. It could be with a clergy. You need to find out what that is, because you used a great term that I like to use a lot too, which is a blind spot. The reality is you can't see it, most likely.
Right. That's why it's called a blind spot. Yeah.
But other people can. And if you're able to create a relationship with a small group or with an individual where you can be vulnerable and share stuff, they might see that. Unfortunately, even if they tell it to you, you probably won't believe it. It's something you got to figure out on your own. But when you have other people being vulnerable and you can start to recognize their blind spots, then you'll hopefully ask yourself, I wonder what mine are. And they might become obvious to you. So for example, I'll give you, so I was raised by a mother and a grandmother, right? Basically, mm-hmm. Men were evil. Men will abandon you. Men will beat you when they get drunk. Men are just bad people. And that's the foundational value system that I was submerged in as a child.
Mm-hmm.
The blind spot for me was, even though I had a very successful career and went to a great law school and did a lot of amazing things, is I was never able to find a mentor who was senior to me to guide me in my career.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I could come up with 1,000 excuses why not, you know, but I think after all the work I've done I burned down my psychic delusion house and I had to rebuild it. And I've rebuilt it as an adult, and I've worked very hard to understand what are the components of that psychic delusion house and to build a good one. Mm-hmm. But I think that environment that I came from created a baseline presumption that men are bad and you can't trust them. Therefore, I wasn't able to develop a relationship, me as the junior mentee and them as the mentor in my career. And I think that hurt my career, but I didn't see it at the time. And I'm not trying to blame my mother and grandmother. They had their experiences. But what it did was it created a value system in me, a narrative or a story that I kept playing out, even though it wasn't my story, it was their story.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what we do as family. And I would caution parents and fathers to, you know, what are the narratives that you're hardwiring almost into your kids?
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to make sure they're ones that'll suit them well as they grow up. And it doesn't have to be all this negative stuff. And so I would contend we all have to look at that. And we want to have brave kids, though, not safe kids. I think that's the other thing that I see today, is that these mothers are such type A's that they even schedule their kids' play dates, for heaven's sakes. These kids aren't allowed to do any free range stuff. They're not allowed to be bored or do anything. But they're also not allowed to have any risk. And I'm not saying that risk, I'm not saying crazy stuff, don't let them get in the car at 14 and drive themselves if they haven't learned how to drive. I'm not saying that. But the kids need to learn to be brave, not safe. That should be your goal as a parent, I think.
Yeah. Well, and have opportunities to learn judgment and decision making, and when things are maybe not a good idea, and when they are.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We part of that burning down my psychic delusion house and rebuilding it has shown me that most of reality is the inverse of what we think it is. Mm. So, there's an example. We should set boundaries for kids, right? When we hear that, we think the boundary is for the kid. No, it's your boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't enforce your boundary, then they'll just keep pushing.
Right.
But you have to realize the boundary is yours, not theirs. And most parents think of it the other way. I told you this is the rule. Well, then you better enforce that rule if that's the boundary you have. And you better enforce it 100% of the time. And if that's how much time they spend online, if it's how much TV, how much they eat, I don't care what it is. But realize that those boundaries are your boundaries. You own them. You control them. They're not the kids' boundaries. The kids' job is to push boundaries, to find out where they are, and then decide through rational thought as they develop what's good for them. I had this issue with my son, who, you know, is attending a university back east and joined a fraternity. And, you know, your kids may be younger, but I don't know if you were in a fraternity, but they have a deserved reputation for partying hard and drinking a lot.
Right.
And he started having problems. And so we had this discussion multiple times. And he kept saying, what I taught him was, I don't care that you violated your own boundary. I want you to recognize the consequences of it and decide, was that boundary a good one for you or not?
Mm-hmm.
And what should the boundary be? Because I wanted him to learn it was his boundary. I wasn't going to tell him that he would disappoint me if he did something. Of course he disappointed me if he did it. I don't have to say that, but it's not my boundary, it's his. He's got to learn to set his own boundaries too when they get to a certain age. Yeah. And he's learned to do that, but at a great cost, I think.
Yeah.
And I hope that we can teach our kids that the boundaries are ours, but then they learn to set their own and that you call them on it. One of the terms I like to use is that of an enlightened witness. There's a great Swiss psychologist. She was a practicing one and then wrote a bunch of books in German, translated into English. Alice Miller is her name. And Alice Miller wrote a book, The Drama of the Gifted Child, which is all children are gifted. She didn't mean gifted as in they got an IQ of 150, which just the translation came out that way, right?
Sure.
But her concept was be an enlightened witness for your kids. Hmm. And that also means being a front row, cheering them on at every event that they have. You should go to every event they have. You should cheer them on. But the enlightened witness will still call BS when there's a reason to call BS on them and ask them to make an informed decision. And if you're thinking they're making a decision that's not informed, the enlightened witness keeps asking questions to try to see if they can learn what they need to learn to make an informed decision.
Mm-hmm.
So that concept is one of the tools that I love to use. And it names itself. Enlightened witness. Yeah, I want to be an enlightened witness. Meet your kids where they are. Yeah, meet your kids where they are. Life happens for you, not to you. Mm. Yeah, those are very important little nuggets that keep me going and terms that I use and I try to practice in my everyday life. On the good side of this, if you can get to there and have that relationship, I think I misquoted it. So I actually had 259, I wrote it down, touches with my kids in the past 7 days, 259 times. And it could just be a heart. It could just be one word at the end of the night, love. It doesn't matter. They need to know you love them and you're thinking about them. Mm-hmm. And especially if they're away, my daughter goes to school back east and I live in San Francisco. So even in high school, both my kids were away from me, not just when I was in prison. And so you've got to touch them as many times as you need to touch them or as many times as you can to let them know you're thinking about them. And that's healthy for them. That's not unhealthy. It's a way of helping them know they're safe. And then they can learn to take the smart risks, not the dumb one as coping mechanisms, but the ones they need to grow and develop, which is what you want for them. You want to encourage that. That's what an enlightened witness does. That's why you're their front row at a sporting event to cheer them on.
Yeah. What I really like about the touches that you shared and how you're tracking that is I think it's applicable to so many things, but it reminds me of, you know, the saying, what gets measured gets done oftentimes, right? So if we have an intentionality that we're going for, in our minds, we might think, oh, I do that all the time. But quantifying that and actually looking at that will tell you if you have or not. For those in the business world, it's your metrics. So like we all have metrics galore in many cases. For the business leaders, you're doing OKRs, you got your KPIs, like all these things. You got all these metrics that you're doing day in, day out. What are your metrics for home? What are your metrics for your friend relationships? But I love how you've quantified that. So then, and you've defined what a touch is as well. Because sometimes, you know, you can take liberties with what an interaction might be if you don't define it. If it has no definition, then it could be a lot of things. But I like that because it sounds like that's been a really good tool mechanism for you to actually quantify and show like the engagements that you have with your kids, because that's important to you. And, you know, in 259 in the last week with all the things going on, you could get 3 weeks down the road and see that that's 50. And depending on what your goals are or what you measure as success with that relationship, that could be really bad, right? What's your suck bar? What's your low end threshold that you need to re-engage because it's fallen? So no, I really like how you've quantified that.
Well, you know, and part of it is some of them are with intention. So for example, I mentioned my daughter's, I've had a more difficult time reestablishing my connection with her after I got out of prison.
Was she six? Was she the younger one?
She was the younger one.
Yeah. Okay.
And so I'd hurt her more, right? In many ways. She was only six when I went away. Mm-hmm. And I abandoned her in her mind, right? And I'm not saying she thinks that. I'm saying that's what emotional six-year-olds, that's their developmental level. That's the way they're going to process. I don't care what you say.
Right.
Right. So how do I, first of all, dads, if there's any way not to lose your children's respect, take it. If you still got their children's respect, I don't care if you're faking it. Thank God you still got it. Keep it, because getting it back is so much more difficult than losing it. I've tried to regain my daughter's trust. So she's got a cat named Milky Way. And when she's away at school, I take care of her cat. I volunteer, say, let me take care of Milky Way. You're away at school. Mom's busy. I'll do it. And a lot of those touches may just be me sending her a photo of Milky Way so that she knows her cat is okay. And the dad honors his commitments. And when he says he's going to do something, he does it. And he doesn't do it, in a forgetful way. He's relentless in staying focused on it as her dad. And that's one of the ways I've tried to rebuild trust with my daughter, is taking, you know, Snapchat or Instagram photos and sending them to her of her cat.
Mm-hmm.
But it's deliberate, right? I know I have to rebuild trust with her, and I know it's not easy, but I've gotten a lot closer to that. And I've got a great relationship, the co-parenting construct, you know, her mom, their mom came to me less than 6 months into my prison sentence and said she wanted a divorce. That burned down as much of my psychic delusion house as my crime did, to be honest. And I was very concerned that she would vilify me and that I would completely lose my kids. But to her eternal credit, and I will always be grateful to her, she honored her commitments and knew that having their dad in their lives was important. And she kept those kids in my life. She helped me to stay connected to them. When you're in prison, you don't have many chances. You can have a 15-minute phone call where they're listening to it with security and your inmates around you are listening to what you're saying. It's very hard to talk on the phone. You can have a visit in the visiting center, which could be a couple hours long. And she brought those kids regularly to visit me while I was in San Quentin, the whole 6 years I was there. And I will always be grateful to her for that. Always be grateful for her for that. But I've also worked to relearn her trust. So I mentioned my daughter. My daughter was away at school, and the ex, as I like to call my mom, not Twitter, but the ex. She said that because my daughter didn't like her, the color of her room, her bedroom walls.
Mm-hmm.
And so I repainted her bedroom while she was away. And I wanted to show her I loved her and I cared about her and that I wanted her to be happy. And that really helped. When she got home for spring break, she was just happy as could be about the new lighter pink color for her bedroom walls. But, you know, we went out to dinner before she went back to school. And I think that first conversation we had since she had seen the work I had done was very intimate, much longer. She was much more vulnerable about the challenges she was facing. She's a senior in high school. And I had a great conversation with her. You can earn those things, but part of that is to recognize if you've lost trust, how do you regain it? You can't just demand because I'm your father. You can't just say, it hurts me when you do this, child. Like, they're children. What are you putting that on them for?
Right.
But try to regain that trust. And that's what I've worked very hard at. And I've had success at to be back to that pride issue. I got to be careful, but yes, I've had success at it. Evidenced by, 259 touches in the past week, as far as I'm.
As you're talking through this and sharing what you've been intentionally doing to rebuild the trust because of what happened, my mind has gone a couple places, and one of the places that it's gone is, and there's a term regarding trust, and if you haven't heard it, here you go. Trust is collected in drops and spilled in buckets, and it can take something very quickly that spills that bucket. So then you have to go and rebuild and recollect in those drops. And
I like that. Yeah, it is drops. It's drops. It just takes so much work.
It's drops after drop after drop. But as you're talking about it, you're doing this because of your time for 6 years away, right? Because of a decision that was made and an outcome that happened and a consequence. And so you were serving that time. The thing that comes to mind is, man, like you're gaining it back. Why don't we do those things before we've lost it?
Well, and you talk about
it's a good reminder.
You talk about a lot of fathers who travel a lot for business. Yeah, you think you're traveling for business. Depending on the developmental level of your children, they might think it's something else. And you need to be very cognizant of that. And you need to find a way to inoculate them from the risks associated with you being gone in their minds at their developmental level. And it's not buying them a tchotchke from the new country you just visited at the end of your trip. That ain't going to do it.
Right.
And I'm not going to, you figure out what you need to do as a dad. But if you're traveling a lot, you have extra work to do because you're gone. And depending on their developmental level, that could have a much bigger impact on them. And they may interpret it more negatively than you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
You can just say, hey, I'm working hard for the family. They don't understand that.
Right.
They just know dad's not there.
In the void of a narrative, the narrative is usually not positive. And I talk about some of my story and experience, and a big part of the reason I stopped doing it was because of some boundaries or goals that I had set for myself coming out of college. Three main things. And I found, 8 years later, I had basically screwed up on the two big ones, right? Two out of three. I loved that. I loved it. I had an amazing team, an amazing company, was fortunate enough to be in a place at the time, at the age that I was in, to be in a great position. But I just had one of those aha moments that was probably a collective of things over time. One of the biggest ones was when, early on, my son would, he was still really young, but he would sit in my suitcase. Yeah, so that one hurt. Because it was only the last few years that I had kids in traveling. Now, I'm going to come back to that in a minute. But it's when he didn't miss me anymore that I was like, something is amiss with the goals that I had set. And one of the goals that I had set that I'm referring to was I'm not going to leave my kids. But you know, for the sake of providing for the family, that came up in a conversation in a previous episode, is like, while you're providing, quote unquote, for your family, make sure you take account of what you're doing to your family. And where, if I could go back, there's mm-hmm. things like modern day is so much different. Even you know, this is 6 years ago when I stopped that frequent of travel. It's very different. I mean, we're talking here very clearly coast to coast. I remember the first time Skype started coming in, and I bought, you know, 10 megapixel webcams and sent it to my team, and they thought I was nuts. Because I'm like, hey, we're gonna have a team meeting. It's very different now, but there are things, and there are some guys that have done it so successfully. And I was very fortunate to have, you mentioned a mentor, have a mentor that was with that same organization for 20 plus years and very well respected. And his character was very high, and just, he was a stellar man and was a big mentor to me. All that to be said, there's one guy that I think of as you're saying that, like, it's not just the tchotchke, you know, that you buy, that you give them to him at the end. But one guy I know, it had a version of that whole flat Stanley thing and would take pictures all over, you know, whether it was the little flat Stanley or if it was a little stuffed animal or something like that, would take pictures all over wherever he was and send them throughout. Right. So you're constantly still engaged in a different way. You got to get creative, because you're not there physically, and making that time. Like, there's things that I could armchair quarterback myself so many years later, say, okay, what would I do differently? And maybe one day I'll be back in that world, because there's a lot of really awesome things about it too. But at least I've been able to go through it and learn, and also learn from others, which is why I love doing this podcast and listening to other guys' podcasts that are doing a similar things, because I can try to reinvent the wheel all I want myself, but man, if somebody's a chapter ahead or two chapters ahead or learn something good, like, I don't have to reinvent the wheel. I can try those things, and maybe they work for me, maybe they don't. But anyway, so the big takeaway for me on that one is, as you're talking through regaining those drops of trust, I'm thinking through why I'm in some, like, why I'm not putting those drops of trust while I still have it and haven't spilled the bucket. Just keep building on it. So I really appreciate you hitting that up and talking about it. Before we wrap, one question I've got is, we've talked a lot about kind of the pre-event, so to speak, right? And then you were in for 6 years, and then we've talked some of where we are now. What happened, and what was it like when you got out after 6 years? And so now you've got a 12-year-old and a 14-year-old, and that's, you know, a lot happens during that time. You've gone from kindergarten, roughly, or first grade to middle school. You know, that's like the starting point of regaining some of those drops. What was that like for you?
I had learned to ask for help in that process. And I had stayed attuned as best I could, to meeting my children where they were. My son had just started, high school back east, so he wasn't home when I got home. But when he got back for his first break, even though it was raining, I was there to meet him at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we went out to the local park, and he got to show me his 6 different pitches, because he was on the JV, you know, team in baseball at his high school. But he also wanted to show me his 3-point shot, because Steph Curry's out here and he's a big Steph Curry fan. I'm awful at basketball. And he remembered me as being a much better baseball player than I ever was. I played, but I wasn't really good, because, you know, that's what little kids build up their dads, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to do what he wanted to do. And he needed to show me the things that were important to him. And I took advantage of that. And I shared that with him. And that helped to reconnect. Again, the tapestry wasn't destroyed, but we had to weave new threads back in there to bring it back together. And it's always good to start from a place that they're already at. Again, where are they? My daughter, as I said, was more challenging, but at the time she was really into the Rick Riordan books, Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief and all of these. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them,
yep.
But there's a ton of them. And he goes through all the different gods, Greek gods, the Roman version of the Greek gods, Aztec gods, Norse gods, Egyptian gods. I don't know how many more, but all these other ones. But these kids that are in these books, many of them are very lonely, raised by a single parent, or orphaned, or with challenges like ADD or whatever else that they're going through in their life. And so knowing that these were important to her, I brought up the example of Odysseus, who had this great adventure. And, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey is this amazing story about him coming back. And how, when he got back, nobody recognized him. Not even his wife or anybody, you know, because he had been gone so long and had so many challenges. And I tried to show her how I was like Odysseus, that I had come back after many misadventures of my own making, but nobody recognized me. Mm. And that's okay. I don't need them to recognize me. I'm who I am. I live my life. And I think that's the other thing, is part of teaching them that, again, life happens for you, not to you. I'm not a victim of my life. My life is, and I do the best I can. This year, the kids, for Father's Day, took me to dim sum. And my present was I asked them, what, you know, what have I done that you remember and that you liked seeing me do, or was important as far as you could tell? And you know, my daughter was able to tell me that, yeah, we worked together over the summer. I work with them. I've had 28 jobs now since I've come home from prison. You're disbarred. Nobody at my professional level would trust me again after, even though sobriety is central to my identity now and I haven't drank.
Yeah.
They don't know that. I don't blame them. You know, that's the way they take it. But one of the jobs I had over the summer was working in a catering company. And I wanted my kids to learn how to work so they could appreciate the value of money. So both of my kids worked at the catering company with me.
Mm-hmm.
And for her to say, you know, Dad, wow, I came back and, you know, I was working with them and I was just shocked how everybody respects and loves you. She goes, the back of the house, the front of the house, the servers, the cooks, the owner, she goes, everybody loves working with you, and how you always chip in, even if it's not your job, if you see something that has to be done, that you're always in a good mood about it. And, you know, if you have any biblical experience, it's like Joseph, right, in the coat of many colors. He always did the best. He might end up being a slave, but he's going to be the best slave there is, right?
Right.
You can't decide what life's going to throw you all the time, but you can decide how you react to it, how you deal with it. And so for her to recognize that I tried to be the best server and temporary captain when they need one that I could be, that was really important to me. But I had to show it to her. The other thing I think parents do too much of is telling. They're not going to learn you from telling. You got to show them what you're doing,
yeah,
and point it out to them so they can see the examples. That's essential. And so she recognized that. And I think that was a very important moment for us and an example of what could work. To reestablish those connections. I had never worked at a catering company. The only reason I did was because both my kids were considering working there during the summer. But they gave me a chance to be with them, and I was going to take that chance.
Yeah.
Now, not every dad could do that. I get it. But I did, and it has paid big dividends.
Mm. Well, maybe not every dad can do something like that. The question is, where are the opportunities that we can step in? And I agree 110% about the telling. I mean, it applies to a lot of things, but what you do and what you show is much more powerful than what you say. and especially the younger kids. But that's, I mean, that's beyond the formative years. You're still setting that example. So I just want to applaud you for going in with that mindset and going in with that Joseph mindset, going in with the, you know, hey, this happened. I learned from it. And you did come out and they changed, but it sounds like you changed too during that time. And you're using it in a positive way. And I want to say thank you for, you know, using that story for betterment of both yourself, but for others too.
It's very kind of you to say, Zach. I am, if we can work together in our conversation and it keeps people interested enough that they'll gain, you know, an idea or a concept or just that it's possible. I don't care what challenges you could be a divorced dad. You could travel a lot for work. I was in prison for 6 years and I've reestablished a great connection with my kids. You can do it too. Yeah. Just meet them where they are, be an enlightened witness to them. And you're going to get 90% there with those two simple concepts.
Love that. And I want to add one on that. I'm just curious if you guys want a little challenge for this week, count your touch points. And not just like your request touch points. Like I'm going to put a little bet. You talk about rules and boundaries outside of like, hey, can you do the chores, dishes, or requests to do X, Y, Z? What are your
instructions? Yeah, I like that.
Instructions, right? Your touch points. So that's a challenge for everyone listening and for me. And I'm really interested and excited and nervous about what I'm going to find, because I can already tell you right now, in some areas, touch points are really good. And then in some, they're not. And I know we talk a lot about kids because this is a Skilled Dad podcast. For those of you that are married, yeah, maybe doubly that with your wife and check that, because eventually the kids grow up and ideally are going to be in a place that they're going to successfully go and live their own life. And it's you and your wife again. And so, you know, that is a powerful relationship that they need to be able to see and learn from, but also we want to invest in check your touch points. So that's good, man. Wayne, where can people learn more about you, follow you, if they want to learn more, after listening to just a tidbit of your story?
Thanks for saying that. Yeah, I'm on the board of an organization called Man to Man, which tries to teach fatherhood values to inner city youth and at-risk men in prison. So I'm going to send you the link to Man to Man so that you can put it in the show notes.
Awesome.
And for my stuff, you can just find my name and I'll send you the link on Substack. I'm on Substack and on Medium as two platforms where I write a lot about my journey and my observations. I'll send you the links for that. But just Wayne Boatwright, a search on LinkedIn will find it, or on Substack or on Medium, you'll find my stuff.
Okay, perfect.
And it's all outside the paywall, even though those guys have them. So it's all for free. Nobody has to join anything or do anything to read them.
Okay. Yeah, send me the links. And guys, you'll find them both in the show notes, as well as you can go to skilledad.com, where there's a breakdown of each episode once I have them up. And what I include on that is like three. It's hard to do sometimes with these great conversations, but like three main takeaways. Sometimes we'll put four or five in there if it's just like loaded. You'll see the takeaways. You'll see relative links and shout outs. So those links will live there, and then also transcript of this time. But Wayne, again, I know we touched on just a portion of it, but I found it very fruitful. And again, just applaud you for using your story in a positive way to help others. And you've gained a perspective that many won't have, but the perspective, it sounds like, has allowed you, afforded you the opportunity to do some powerful things with it. So again, thank you for using it in the service of others, and thank you for your time here with me on Skill Dad Podcast. I enjoyed it.
Been a pleasure, Zach. Thank you.
Guys, if you've made it this far, I know you've gotten something from Wayne's story, and I just want to say thank you for being part of the conversation. You're not maybe talking where we can hear you, but if we're talking right now, you're part of the conversation. And the conversation here is for you. It's for me. It's for all of us, regardless of where you are, how many kids you have, what ages they are. There's things that we can learn from each other so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Or in some cases that we get a little bit of a knock on the head in the safe environment of a podcast, because like with Wayne's story, that driving moment is one that I'm going to venture to say many of you or us may have fallen into at some point in our lives. It's an easy thing to look at and say, I'm fine. And in this context, we're talking about the, you know, alcohol and the coping side of it. It's harder to catch ourselves beforehand and step back and say, okay, what do I have? Where are we? And how can I continue to refine myself and build myself so that, like on an airplane, you got to put the oxygen mask on yourself first before you put on the kids, because if we're not in the fight, we're not there to help them. So we have to take care of ourselves, and then we can go and be most effective with them. If you thought of somebody through this story, please share it with them. That's the main thing, is that we can help each other, and would love to hear your feedback, as well as anything that, you know, you'd like for us to chime into or chime on and talk about. But you can find us at skilledad.com. Again, I hope you took something away from this that you can apply into your life on your journey to becoming Skilled Dad.